Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. We're going to fire up the dorm room bong for a discussion of the new David Foster Wallace movie, The End of the Tour, based on a book by David Lipsky called Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself. USC professor and author Josh Kuhn is here to talk about his book To Live and Dine in L.A. and tell us about a live event happening here in Los Angeles on August 9th called To Live and Dine in L.A., a mixtape. And if you're tired of hearing about ISIS and Donald Trump, here's some good news. BJ Novak was going to be on the show last week, but sitting in the green room, he had an existential crisis and went home. He thought about it and sent us this wonderful email, and I'm happy to report he'll be on the show today. Joining me are my co-hosts and partners in crime, the professor, the founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom. You look good. You're wearing black today. What's that about?
I'm just feeling very mournful.
Are you in mourning for your life?
Mourning becomes you. And she's a critic. She's an author. You know her as Lori Weiner. Hello, Lori.
Hey, Doe. That's Swedish, because we're watching Wallander.
My question for you this week is, what is Wallander?
It's a show from Sweden.
It's a Swedish cop procedural.
Another Swedish cop procedural. I have another question.
Love it. Based on Henning Mankell's character.
Oh, of course. Henning Mankell, the Swedish crime writer who sets up a problem. A cat goes up a tree. He shakes a stick at the cat.
That's
the cat
guy.
Comes down the tree. That's how it works. The writer getting the most media oxygen lately is David Foster Wallace. And one of the reasons for this is there's a new movie out called The End of the Tour, directed by James Ponsoldt and starring Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg. And because this is a literary show, I am contractually bound to tell you it's based on a book by David Lipsky, a book called Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself. Tom, you went on a press junket where they were promoting this movie. And of course, the movie is about a book tour, and irony layers on irony.
This has to be a little bit meta for you guys, right? It's you're doing a days of interviews about a movie about days of interviews.
Yeah.
Is that, and are you finding any of the same things happening to yourselves that you're feeling the resentment of the interviewers?
No, not until now.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
I actually think it's funny, but this is a movie that really resonates with interviewers because it's a subject they're so familiar with. And it brings up these interesting questions about, like, where is the line between good taste and doing your job as an interviewer?
Yes, right. Well, I'm going to try to cross that line.
Absolutely,
yeah. I see that as my job. And now, the Lipsky book is in interview form, obviously. And then the screenplay is a distillation of that set of interviews. But to prepare for it, you listen to the tapes themselves as well as reading the book. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I read Lipsky's book when it came out, and then Donald's script he wrote from the book, from speaking to Lipsky. Donald did not listen to the tapes. I spoke to Lipsky and asked him if I could have the tapes and then made them available to both Jason and Jesse. And they were a great resource, but it was also sort of something we were very clear that we didn't want to do impersonations of these people. Mm.
Yeah, well, it was really helpful to me, especially there's some weighty conversation in the movie and some very tense scenes.
Of course.
What was really important to me when I listened to those tapes was to realize that there's also a lot of fun. And it's 4 days with two guys in a car. You're bound to drop any artifice and at some point start talking about what's on the radio. And that was what was really interesting about the tapes to me, is they also just, like, shot the shit.
Let's talk a little bit about constructing the character, your character. You work together, obviously, to figure out how to take what's basically a lot of internal stuff and externalize it. Did the screenplay, was it built to do that already, or did you have to figure out?
Well, the screenplay is taken from the actual interviews.
Right.
So really, a lot of what I had to say was straight out of David Foster Wallace's mouth. I didn't have to second guess if any of that stuff was correct. It was said. And then a narrative was created by Donald Margulies, who's as talented a writer as exists on this planet. And so I had total confidence in the words. I wanted to get them exactly right. And I wanted to do some of the external stuff in a way that honored the fact that this is a real man who means a lot to a lot of people and has family and things like that. What was most important to me, though, was to capture the heart of it and the spirit of it, because I think that the movie is a real extension of David Foster Wallace's writing. I feel like the same themes we explore in this are what he explored in This Is Water and in Infinite Jest. This question of, hey, is anyone else finding that maybe they've been lied to, that we've been told that we're going to feel a certain way if we achieve these things, and then you get there and it doesn't exist?
Hmm. You talk movingly about reading Infinite Jest, and part of that is there's a kind of philosophical version of what you just said, which is that at some point you realize the world is not as we were told. But you also talk about it as a life stage, as a moment at which you... Right?
Yeah, well, I think you spend your 20s and maybe your early 30s, or I guess it varies from person to person, but trying to get there. Then you find out that there does not exist, and it just keeps moving, and like... in a lot of ways, sort of equidistant from where you started. It's just you never even get any closer. I think human nature is that you narrow the criteria of success so that you're always losing. Like once you accomplish something, you move the standard away from you for some reason. And then there's this suggestion that David Foster Wallace offers of, well, what if you place your value somewhere else? What if it's being a good friend and showing up for the people around you and just being a part of what's going on, no better, no worse? Then, surprise, you're there already.
And James, you see David Foster Wallace's work as in a continuum of American and European innovative literature. So you talk about Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, and then Tom Wolfe and Kerouac are the four that I've seen you mention in relation to this. The first two famous for structural formalist innovation, and the next two famous for their relation to the real. And both of these are fundamental Wallace concerns.
Yeah, well, I think when Wallace came out of college, went to Arizona for his MFA, I mean, the fiction that was in vogue at the time was sort of a type of Raymond Carver realism, which he certainly wasn't. I think he was harkening back, you know, 20-odd years, 15, 20 years to postmodernists of the 60s, people who were writing absurdist literature, you know, the Pynchons, the Barths, stuff like that, stuff that wasn't necessarily in vogue at the time. And I think, though, when Infinite Jest came out, and when Shipping Out, the essay that was retitled supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, came out, there was a sense, which was described to me as by someone as verbal cocaine. There was the sense that something in fiction had shifted, that someone was writing for our generation. Huh. That's sort of some of those authors that I, you know, mentioned and that sort of come up in dialogue. It's that suddenly there's a new way of writing. And I think for fans of Wallace and for people that read Wallace's essays or Infinite Jest or jump from one to the other, there was a sense that someone was able to articulate the experience of being alive in the 1990s, you know, of feeling that there's so many opportunities for entertainment and pleasure, so many things pulling at our attention, more and more tiny screens popping up, things that seem prescient now that he was talking about almost 20 years ago, that he was able to articulate that in his writing, that now a young writer like, say, a David Lipsky would have to contend with that.
And of course, Gertrude Stein felt the same way to her audience, right? Like that she somehow had figured out modernism before it happened.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
Now, do you feel that by concentrating on this little section of time, this little short piece of time, you got away from the problems of the biopic?
I mean, for me, the problems of the biopic, you know, I mean, with a film, when you have 100 to 120 minutes, that's just not a lot of time. And I think what you get, the cliches of the biopic are things that there's a type of easy pop psychology or easy conclusions, easy through lines that are drawn. Someone's stung by a bee when they're 7. That sort of can predict why they're going to have success or failure or marriage or divorce 30 years later. They simply can't. That's reductive, and that's sort of someone trying to conform to a 3-act structure. People's lives are messy and complicated, mm-hmm. and people have mysterious inner lives. So I wouldn't know how to have that or how to even aim for that omniscient sort of God's eye perspective. What we had an opportunity for here was to tell a hyper subjective story about David Lipsky's experience spending several days with someone who was a stranger to him, but who he'd thought about a lot and was probably measuring himself against a little bit, as every young author was at the time. And we're speaking to that experience while hopefully honoring the memory of David Foster Wallace.
I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner on KPFK 90.7 FM. And remember, it's the fund drive, so please donate at 818-985-5735.
fantastic conversation. I was incredibly impressed by both of them. They had very smart things to say about the nature of the project that they were doing, about the psychology of that Lipsky-Wallace interface. And it was just one of those conversations, one of those literary conversations that was just superb.
By Lipsky-Wallace interface, you mean?
Well, the film is about a three-day Rolling Stone interview that David Lipsky did with David Foster Wallace right after Infinite Jest came out, I believe.
Yeah, and interestingly, the piece that Lipsky wrote never appeared in Rolling Stone.
Right, but it appeared as a book much later.
What'd you think of the film, Tom?
I loved it. I did. I just loved it. I thought it's a tough thing to do, have a movie about writing. Nothing really happens. I mean, you can't imagine this as a studio pitch. It's just two guys talking. And it's a little chess game. And I think it's a beautiful little film.
Laurie, what do you think?
I think I had the discomfort that one has when one sees one's own profession depicted, because I have done a lot of interviews and magazine interviews. And to see what you do depicted can make you very uncomfortable, especially when it is a morally questionable, as Janet Malcolm says, morally indefensible profession, in that you are acting as if you're the subject's best friend and you want to know everything about him, which you do, but for very selfish reasons, and you will throw him under the bus in a second if it's going to make your story better. And I remember when I was doing reporting about theater, and those personalities in the theater were so colorful, I had this experience, which was just sit perfectly still. Don't in any way tip your hand that you're loving this, because it could stop. And
this is why you're such a good poker player.
Well, I remember Laurie told me a story about interviewing Geraldo Rivera when she was a young woman. And she goes into the room and Geraldo is coming off set. And the first thing he does is change his shirt, slowly takes his shirt off. Basically does a striptease for her.
And that is a great feeling, because you want to skewer Geraldo. I mean, yeah, it feels great.
Sure,
you know,
but the movie does the opposite of skewering. It's a hagiography. The performances are terrific. I think Jason Segel is a revelation. What's interesting to me is the David Foster Wallace of it all, because I remember the 1970s pretty vividly, when there was a writer who was in the book bag of everyone at every college, and that was Kurt Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. And Kurt Vonnegut is, while not forgotten, he is not in that place in the pantheon that he occupied back then. And I wonder if that is not where David Foster Wallace is headed.
I do not think that is where David Foster Wallace is headed. Time will tell.
I think that there is something about Wallace's work which really attracts young readers. And it probably will continue to do that. I've said this before, but I think that reading goes in stages, like Erickson's life stages, and that when you're in your identity crisis, books about identity are really important. When you're in your intimacy crisis, books about intimacy are really important. And I don't know, you know, my stage of life, which is codgerdom, it's a different kind of relation to the written word. Now, what the film did, I thought, was take those kinds of issues. Wallace is worried about how he's going to be perceived by this, what he sees as this kind of slick interviewer from a slick magazine, Rolling Stone. And Lipsky is very concerned about how he's going to be perceived by a literary idol who is getting all of the attention that Lipsky wished he could get himself as a novelist, and he's not getting. So they're both kind of fighting their own battles about their own identities and about their own senses of self. And I found it completely compelling. And that suggests that perhaps these issues, which are fundamental to Wallace's work, will continue to be found compelling for readers for time immemorial.
No, maybe. At any rate, the movie is worth seeing. It's called The End of the Tour. Josh Kuhn is here. He's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at USC. He is an author of To Live and Dine in L.A. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
You're doing an event called a live mixtape. What is that?
Yeah, so it's the finale for this project, August 9th at the Regent Theater downtown, and something I dreamt up with Chef Roy Choi and Rocket Era Science, who's a hip-hop MC from Dilated Peoples. We thought it'd be really cool to bring a whole kind of random group of people together, put them on stage, and kind of create what a mixtape feels like when you're listening to it, but actually get to watch it on stage. All in an attempt to kind of tell stories about food history, food culture, and food justice and injustice here in Los Angeles. The whole time on stage, there'll be a DJ on one side of the stage on his ones and twos, and then on the other side of the stage, there'll be Roy on his ones and twos to induction burner stoves. And so Roy will be cooking at the same time that the DJ is DJing. It's going to be like no other night. It could be a total disaster, but I think it's going to be like you got to be there to witness it.
How do people get
tickets?
That's
a great sell, by the way.
Yeah, it is. Seriously. Well, you want to be there.
How do you get tickets?
I like events that are on the edge of greatness or just horrible.
Total catastrophe.
Total catastrophe. Potential. You've got to come to that. You can go to the Regent's website. They're $20 tickets. Lots of food also on site. The restaurant there at the Regent's going to be cooking from old menus from the library's menu collection. And then we got some great food trucks like Kogi and Ricky's Fish Tacos and other folks who are going to be slinging food at the end.
One of the great things about to live and dine in LA is that you've got a bunch of old ads for restaurants and menus from restaurants, and really kind of gives you a sense of food history as people experience that history. And one of the things that I remember from doing research at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, the menus that Diamond Jim Brady would eat.
Where
he didn't eat the menus.
The first course would be, lobster. The second course would be, clams. The third course would be another lobster. Right. And then there would be, three or four fowl, and then there would be several sides of beef. It was just like a menu that went on and on and on. And you couldn't imagine anyone eating it.
Have you been to the French Laundry lately?
Well, the French Laundry are a little place. These are like, you get a 3-pound lobster as one of 40 courses. Yeah. Did you find some of that like absolute excess as part of the...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's of course a long history, as you know, of absolute excess as kind of a marker of social class, right? So, the more you can eat, the wealthier you are, and especially if the all you can eat has some connection to France, then you really must be powerful. So the idea of a feast, of a royal feast, of a banquet, of being able to stuff yourself and stuff your body, right, is a sign of power, a sign of privilege. And so a lot of the early menus that we have in the library's collection that we talk about in the book from the late 1800s, early 1900s, are banquet menus, private, elegant, upper-class banquet menus. The earliest menu in the collection that we have in the book is from 1875. Was from a feast, the annual feast and ball that Don Mateo Keller threw at his winery on Alameda and 7th in 1875. And it's similar. It's not divided into meat, poultry, and seafood. It's, broiled meats. Broiled meats, boiled meats, grilled meats, and it's endless. And then it ends, I forget the exact combination, but it's it's like a turducken, basically. It's like a veal stuffed with this, stuffed with that. Mm-hmm. So I think you certainly see that. But then by the early, once you get in like 1920s, one of the things that stood out as a kind of quintessentially LA were like lunchrooms, for lack of a better term, that would just have menus that seemed to go on forever. That would be, 30 different relishes to choose from, to put on 50 different kinds of oysters, 60 different poultry dishes. There's one menu from, I think it's a Jonka's Bar and Grill that had like notebook tags, like index tags on the menu, so like it's that thick that you might lose your place and want to like, oh, now where was the 300 relishes? Let me go back to page 18. In the early part of the 20th century, that was a sign of power and prestige, where now it's a sign of, kind of a failure in contemporary food culture.
Right.
Absolutely. You don't want to say, oh, yes, we have steak from all around the world. People are not going to go there anymore.
But you do talk about how looking at these menus helps us understand how we got to right now where we are in food culture, and which is that we have a class of people that know a tremendous amount about it and care very deeply. But yet we still have a lot of people going hungry. And
this was the big challenge, was that as soon as I started looking into the archive, I didn't know what kind of book to write. I didn't know if it was going to be a kind of straight food history. I didn't know if it was going to go more into the kind of social, cultural realm that I think it ended up in. The first challenge was looking at this incredible archive. I pulled out all of these banquet menus, which are historically the most kind of quote-unquote valuable menus in the collection. They're the ooh and ah menus. When Haile Selassie came to Los Angeles, this is the menu he ate at his banquet. When Albert Einstein had his dinner, this is what he ate. And seeing them in the space of a public library, the Central Library in the middle of a downtown that now, as we're talking, right, houses both Skid Row and a Whole Foods within mm-hmm. blocks, within a, you know, a 5-minute walk of each other. The downtown that used to be the, you know, an agricultural center of the city in the 19th century, the downtown that is now a hub of feverish gentrification politics, that is the hub of a larger city that has been deemed the epicenter of hunger in the United States, where we're the number one county in the country for young people who are food insecure. And so how are we going to look at this collection of beautiful, gorgeous, fascinating menus that are records of great joy and wonderful nostalgia and memories for so many people that at the same time, ultimately, I realized these are documents of privilege. These are documents of what everybody else was not eating. And that was something when Roy Choi came onto the project, when we started going through the menus, that was the first conversation we started having, was he immediately saw them as class documents, immediately. Mm-hmm. And I give him, you know, all the credit in the world for really sharpening the way that I was reading these menus. Mm-hmm. And that was one of our research questions, is like, how do we put together this history of working class eating in Los Angeles? And what we did find actually was not the kind of black hole that I think we thought we were going to find. We found the opposite, which is that most of the way LA was talked about from, let's say, 1900 to 1940, both in the local press, the regional press, and the national press, was that this was a city where if you were a working person, you could eat out and have a meal that was good on a working wage. It would be quick, and you could get for 15 cents, you could get steak and coffee and pie.
Well, all the old noir films have these great diner scenes, right, where people who are pretty much down and out
right.
are getting a cup of coffee for a nickel and,
absolutely.
And a piece of pie.
Absolutely.
Those institutions didn't work with menus, or the menu is on the wall? Are there images of those?
The kind of menu on the wall problem, as I started to think about it for the book, is like, how do you represent that in the book if there weren't, you know, takeaway menus? And a lot of the early restaurants didn't have menus you held in your hands. They had wall menus or sandwich cards or that kind of thing. As restaurants got bigger, that's when menus were created, because people couldn't see the menu from farther away in the restaurant, so you mm-hmm. need to actually give them something.
I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and we're talking to Josh Kuhn on KPFK 90.7 FM. Remember, it's the fund drive. Please donate at 818-985-5735.
Were you born here?
Yeah, born and raised on the West Side, and I very much grew up in that tradition. My father's father waited tables his whole life at the Brown Derby, at Ollie Hammond's. He was in the food industry. You know, he worked until the day he retired.
What restaurants do you remember going to in Los Angeles?
Well, the one that I probably remember the most, for whatever reason, that's in my head, is Fratello's. Which is an Italian restaurant in a little strip mall on National, just south of the 10. You know, we went there when I was very young a lot. I'd say I feel like we went there weekly, which is probably not true, but I felt like we went there weekly for sure. And it was dark, you know, and they had the wine bottles and the casks on the wall, hanging from the wall, and they would do the fettuccine fantastica, and they would come to the table and they would like cook it at the table. And like, you know, when you're a 7-year-old or something, it's like, what is this? And we ate there so often, and this was like Italian food to me, and really, really good. And the fact that it was in a strip mall, I think, is really important. That it was right by a freeway is really important. And that it was actually Mexican run. And the owners were Mexican, the chefs were Mexican, the waiters were Mexican, everyone who I thought were Italian in the dim light of the Italian restaurant were actually Mexicans. And I think that was also a really important story about the kind of central role that Mexican Americans, Mexican immigrants have played in not just the food industry in Los Angeles, but really in creating the entire food culture of Los Angeles. I ate a lot at like Marty's on Pico, which is a little hamburger stand that's still there next to a fire station. So you could like trade baseball cards in the back. And then, you know, they do the combo up front. So it's like it's a chili cheese burger with the hot dog on the same sandwich. And then if you come early enough, before 11, I think they put an egg on it. And that actually is something that Michael Wexler, who's part of the book, who actually gave me the title for the book very kindly, when he and I started talking about what he would do for this book, that was a subject that came up a lot, is that the idea of the combo, right? That LA seems to be the kind of combo city where it's this, yes, put a hamburger and a hot dog on the same sandwich, put chili and meat on the same sandwich, do a spaghetti burger, do, you know, you drive up and down Jefferson, right? You drive east and west on Jefferson, and almost every corner is tacos, pastrami, and burgers, right? Tacos, pastrami, burgers. And so the idea of LA as a combo city kind of stuck with me a lot, but.
I'm fascinated by the idea of class consciousness in the discussion of food. Is it a way to expiate the guilt of the privileged class to inject a conversation about class consciousness in all of the writing and appreciation about food, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. It's a big question. I actually wouldn't mind if there was some guilt-driven social action happening.
Sure.
Let's have that. I don't think I see it much. I think there's a tremendous disconnect between the obsession with food, with new restaurants, foodism, food scene, tremendous disconnect between that and, you know, liberal-minded folks who actually probably don't think about the economic disparities within their city. And this is, again, this is not about shaming people who will rush to every new restaurant as it opens, not at all, or shaming chefs. But it's about understanding something that I think we all know inherently about food, is that it runs through all these different networks. All eating is about class, as it is always about race, about gender, about all these different categories and all these different hierarchies within our society. Right now, I think there's a lot of stuff. I can just speak in LA, some incredible grassroots community activism going on, particularly in South Los Angeles, of folks from the community who are incredibly smart, incredibly creative, who are building and you know, their own food systems, rethinking what food means in their neighborhood. So I think it's a pretty exciting time. There's definitely top-down stuff that has problems, but I'm more interested in the ground-up stuff.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming in, Josh.
Sure. Thank you, guys.
The book is To Live and Dine in L.A. The event is To Live and Dine in L.A., a live mixtape. It'll be August 9th. Josh, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks to Josh Kuhn. Once again, our apologies to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but he's said he'll come back next week. Our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. Our crack production staff, Eric Webster and Ernesto Aureliano. And of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs, who truly we could not improve upon.
Love you, Sid.
The generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Everybody into the pool.